You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
I'm Blake Smith, the host of Monster Talk. Today we have something appropriate for a cool fall evening. Can a domesticated cat be a monster? What if it could talk or fly? Or predict the future, or grow to enormous size. Get ready for some of the strangest lore we've ever covered on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. In this episode, Dr. Karen Stolzno and I will be interviewing art historian Dr. Paul Kudnaris. Paul has written some books that will probably be of interest to Monster Talk listeners. The Empire of Death is a book about the history of charnel houses and ossuaries. And in his more recent book, Heavenly Bodies, you'll discover astonishing works of art formed by decoration of human remains. During the course of his research, he's become something of an expert on lore surrounding demon cats. And now, the idea of a domesticated cat as a monster may give you pause, but I think you'll find that the stories in this interview are fascinating, and some of the tangents we take may astonish you. It's good stuff for a chill autumn night. Can you hear the leaves rustling in the night wind? Let's cozy up to the fire, grab a warm beverage, and have some
Monster Talk.
Dr. Paul Kudnaris has a PhD in art history and is the author of The Empire of Death, a study of religious sanctuaries decorated in human bone, and the book Heavenly Bodies, a study of 17th century decorated skeletons. He's written for a wide selection of magazines and newspapers, including several features for 40 and Times, and he can be reached at his website, Empire de la Mort, which we will link to in the show notes. But today, we're going to be talking about demon cats. So welcome to Monster Talk.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm pleased to talk about that topic.
So are we. I have to say, we've only covered cats as like alien big cats, which are misplaced large felines people see in different parts of the world. But we haven't really done much on cats as possessed entities. So
this is new.
Yeah, it's kind of it's really old, but very new for us, right? So.
Well, there's also a semantic difference I want to make from the start. There's a difference between calling a cat demonic and calling it demonically possessed. You know, something that is demonically possessed is a normal entity that has been possessed by some kind of outside agency. Something that is demonic is the demon itself. We are talking about cats, normal cats that have been possessed.
Okay.
So how did you become interested in this topic?
Well, that's a real good question. And I got into it in the exact opposite way, because I was very interested in kind of sacred or angelic cats at one point in time. You mentioned my book, Heavenly Bodies, which is a study of these elaborately decorated and jeweled skeletons from the 17th and 18th centuries. And there's this fascinating story from Burglen, Switzerland, about this skeleton that's still to this day, this elaborate skeleton that's on the high altar of the church. And the people in the town used to think that it would leave the skeleton, it would leave its niche in the form of this white ghostly cat. It would walk around the town as this kind of white sacred cat. And apparently some kind of large feral white cat had come into Berglund at some point in time. And they started worshiping it as the ghost of this skeleton. This is an utterly bizarre piece of Swiss folklore. And I became interested in finding other examples, you know, outside of Egypt where sacred cats are well known, other examples of these kind of sacred or angelic cats. And instead, what I found, you know, the cat after Egypt went through a very long period of travail as far as its reputation was concerned. And what I found was this entire history, really folkloric history, of demonically possessed cats, not angelic cats. That was the rarity. There was a large skeleton by the name of St. Maximus in a suit of armor. He was dolled up in the suit of armor and covered in jewels, and he was placed on the high altar of this church. And the full story is that a gold liquid started puddling between his skeletal legs and it was dripping out of his skeletal crotch. And I know that sounds really weird and, you know, and a little bit insidious, but it sounds like something else. But I know what it was. When they would take these skeletons and they would prepare them to be jeweled and put them on an altar, they would cover them over with animal glue as a binding agent to kind of, because these bones were very old and they wanted to keep the bones hard and firm and they wanted to keep them from deteriorating. So as a sealant, they'd cover them with animal glue. And clearly they had prepared the animal glue improperly and it was dripping off the skeleton in this golden pool. But because it was gold, they thought, you know, well, it's gold in color. It must be a portent of some important lesson that we're about to learn. And around that time, some large white feral cat appeared in the village and the cat had walked into the church and they tried to chase the cat out of the church and they said it just disappeared into the altar. Well, I know cats. I have three of them. They're really good at hiding and they'll get into small places, and it was probably in there somewhere in the altar hiding from these townsfolk that were chasing it. But when they saw it disappear into the altar, they decided it must have come from the skeleton, and because it was white, it was, you know, they said it was the ghost of the skeleton, and they kind of took it as an icon. And this cat lived out the rest of its life in its village in the form of, you know, it assumed to be the ghost of this skeleton that had become the patron saint of this town as a kind of, you know, cat god.
It's an incredible story.
Yeah, it really is. It's really a strange story. And more so than that, I started getting into this legend of this cat. I started doing some research, and I even found that, you know, nowadays no one really believes in this, not much, but I even found a 20th century case, a fairly recent case from a couple decades back of a girl from Berglund who claimed that, you know, she had prayed to this cat. And, you know, because the legend of this cat still exists, and this girl from Berglund said she had prayed to this cat and had cured her from some disease and helped her get a job. So she claims, at least there's one girl out there who claims the cat god still, you know, ministers over Berglund.
Wow. But just as a kind of foundation question, just for our listeners, how would you define a demon cat?
Well, again, I'm talking about demonically possessed cats, and I do make that semantic difference, because we're talking about cats that have supposedly been possessed by a demon or some other entity. And that sounds so strange to us now. It's because the reason that sounds so strange is because we have, through horror films, through literature, and also through academia, which is very homocentric, and it concentrates on the human condition so much, we have come to consider demonic possession to be something that is for people. You know, mm-hmm. Demons possess people, and we don't really think of demons possessing other entities or other things. But in fact, back in the day, it was considered very easy for a demon to possess an animal. Think about it this way. The first defense that you have against something diabolic entering you is the ability to have faith. That's the first wall. That's the first fortress, right? A demon has to get past faith in order to take a Christian or, you know, a human being. An animal doesn't have faith, so it was actually much easier for a demon to take control of an animal and do some weird thing than it was for a demon to take control of a person. When you think about it that way, there's actually a logic to it. We just don't think in terms of demons possessing animals because, as I said, we're so used to films like The Exorcist, and we're so used to academic studies of demonic possession, which only focus on human beings, but demons were thought to be able to take possession of animals, and in particular, cats, who were thought to be really bad animals at one time.
I am a cat owner, and I know Karen is.
Yes.
But I'm really curious about how would I distinguish a possessed cat from a mundane cat? What are the symptoms I would be looking for?
Well, you'd be, you know, I get emails from people after I started studying this, and I did some lectures on it. I get emails from people all the time that will tell me, and it's like, hey, you know, I think my cat's possessed. He's, you know, he won't stop pawing at the chair or something. And it's like, buddy, that's cat behavior. Cats do that. A demonically possessed cat will do the exact same kinds of things that a demonically possessed person will do. It might levitate. It might breathe a burst of fire at you. It will speak in tongues. It will do really bad things. It will do the exact same type of things that we would associate with a demonically possessed person, because it's the body of a cat, but it's now controlled by a demon. So it will do the same things that a demonically possessed person will. And there's a really long history of this, you know. The most famous demonically possessed cat is actually supposedly still in Washington, D.C. It's the only demonically possessed cat that has its own Wikipedia page. I've seen it. It's just a stub. It's known as D.C. for District of Columbia or Demon Cat, and it's believed to live in the U.S. Capitol building in a crypt that was it was supposed to be a mausoleum that was intended for George Washington, and they never put him there. And anyway, it turned into this storage space that was supposed to be a crypt, and there's supposed to be this demonically possessed cat that lives down there, and there's this whole history of this thing dating back to the mid-19th century. The whole history of this thing, and it appears apparently before national tragedies. It kind of presages national tragedies. It starts out as a little black kitten. It grows large in size, and then something terrible happens, and it disappears.
Well, I'm just curious now. You mentioned a black cat, and earlier you were talking about a white cat as being a ghost. Yeah. Is it more common for black cats to be demon cats, or does it really have anything to do with color?
In the popular fancy, of course, right? Because you know, it's this system of alterity that we've erected simply by being human beings, where black represents negativity and white represents virtue. In reality, there's no reason why, if you believe in demonic possession, there's no reason why a demon would have any easier time entering a black cat than a white cat. You know, the thing with black cats and the nasty reputation, it predates the witch craze, and it goes all the way back to the Greek worship of Hecate. Hecate was the goddess of magic in ancient Greece, and one of Hecate's symbols was a black cat. And so, you know, and that was a positive or neutral symbol in ancient Greece. But of course, the Christians eventually turned that around. They started associating Hecate with evil witchcraft and tying that to the devil, and the black cat remained a symbol, and then it also became tied to the devil. So really, it's only easier for a demon to possess a black cat in terms of the symbolism. And in reality, if you were a demon, it would be the same no matter the color, breed, or type of cat.
Right. Thank you. And I'm wondering how a cat speaks in tongues. I want to see that.
Yeah.
Well, I have not heard a cat speaking in tongues. All I know is that if you look at the folklore, and if you go into the folklore of cats that have been believed to be possessed, that's one of the things they might do. They might speak in tongues.
I don't find that far-fetched as far as people believing it, because if you look on YouTube, for example, for animals making funny noises, there's a lot of videos of cats and dogs that seem to be talking. You know, whether they're intentionally mimicking human speech, I don't know, but it is it does sound very much like someone talking. And then the cats do that thing. The cats do a thing. Some cats, not all cats, but and we're talking about domesticated cats, but they'll if they see birds, some cats will like go to the window and make these strange like whispering noises. It's very interesting.
It's about the cutest thing that cats do, actually, is that mimicking the bird thing. As if the birds are really that stupid to think, oh, that's just another bird, right?
Exactly.
Well, actually, I don't know if you've ever gotten into this, but there's actually a whole history of supposed talking dogs or dogs that were trained to talk. So there's this whole history, which most of it is probably fictitious, but there is a whole history of supposed talking animals or animals that could communicate in speech. And actually, next week, I'm in the UK doing a couple book talks, and afterward, because I'm very kind of obsessed with eventually writing a book on some of this animal weirdness, I'm going to Germany to try to find the grave of a dog by the name of Kurwanal. And Kurwanal was a famous, very famous talking dog from the 1930s in Germany who had even been interviewed by psychologists. So there's this entire history of animals that really were believed to have the ability to speak.
Well, I know a lot of people believe in the literal Bible, and there's a story of a talking donkey in the Bible, too.
Yeah. Some of them are believed, like the horses that tap things out with their feet. Some of them are believed to not communicate in literal speech, but be able to spell things out and so forth. But there's this whole history of animals that supposedly understand human speech and can respond.
Yeah, I think during World War II, the Nazis actually had an animal talking school where they were trying to teach German Shepherds or Alsatians how to speak, and they were taught phrases like "Who is Adolf Hitler?" and "Give me cakes" and things like that. And
in Weimar, yeah, "Give me cakes" that's very fascist. In Weimar, that's where they did that. And actually, Kurwanal was the first. The dog I was talking about was actually the first talking dog in Weimar, but it wasn't a Nazi talking dog. And it's interesting because after the Nazis came to power, they actually asked him about Hitler, and he told them he would spell out words with his tail. He said, "No, I prefer Hindenburg be chancellor." So Kurwanal was on the other team.
So you kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to know more about the theology or the theological beliefs behind these possessed felines. Is this strictly a Western idea? Or
when we're talking about demonic possession, we're talking about it in a very strict kind of Christian way, because other cultures have demons, but we don't, you know, they don't consider them the way a Christian might in terms of possession and so forth. It's funny because cats had a very high profile in Egypt, and they really fell down to a very low point afterward. Part of the reason maybe is because they were so associated with Egypt that the Hebrews didn't like them. The Israelites really didn't like cats, and maybe because they associated them with Egyptian religiosity and they had escaped from that. But that really carried over into the Christian world, this kind of distrust for cats. It's only in the last 200 years that cats have really been rehabilitated in the West. In the rest of the world, when you're talking about Asia, the rest of the world, cats never really sank to the low point where anyone would be looking for a connection to a demon, for instance. In Asia, there were cultures like in Thailand, for instance, and in Burma, cats were considered royal, and cats still, in some contexts, were continued to be considered divine.
So, talking about cats being divine in a place like Egypt historically, can you tell us a little bit more about that? How did that manifest? How did they treat cats?
Well, I think you and your listeners are all familiar with Bubastis, the city of Bubastis, and Bast or Bastet, the cat goddess, who was considered a daughter of Ra. And so that was, you know, her symbol was the cat. And in the late New Kingdom in Egypt, Bubastis actually did become the royal seat. So it was an actual capital. And you know, cats were considered sacred in that town. There's a famous story, a Roman encyclopedist, Diodorus Siculus, had told this story about how, if you accidentally killed a cat, even if it was by an accident, the penalty was death in the city of Bubastis. And some Roman politician or diplomat had accidentally run over a cat, and even the Egyptian government was saying, this guy is a Roman diplomat, you cannot kill him. And the people of Bubastis stoned him to death. Cats were very, very sacred, in particular in the city of Bubastis, because it was dedicated to the cat goddess, the daughter of Ra.
I guess what I'm curious is, like, the transformation from these sort of pagan roles to being directly tied with witchcraft and other things. And I was wondering, does the demonic possession happen after the cats have been associated with witches?
Yeah, it all comes in hand in hand. You know, demonic possession was not a real big deal in the early Christian world. It kind of comes along later, and it really starts coming along around the same time as the witch hunt starts getting underway. It comes along around the same time. There's this belief that, you know, the devil has this entire army of people and they are witches. And witchcraft or magic had already been diabolized, by this idea, God alone can create a miracle. And so if it doesn't come from God, it's got to come from the devil. And, you know, it's something infernal. And so magic had been associated in Christian theology with infernal powers for a very long time. As I said, cats had been associated with witchcraft since the ancient world. Cats had also been associated with night since the ancient world. So they were associated with these kind of black things, which then, as I said, kind of became diabolized in Christian theology. There was a theory, in fact, that was very popular in Europe at one time, that the reason that cats were asleep during the day and active at night is because they would go out every night and patrol for the devil. They were paid. I don't know what they were paid, how much they were paid, and what they spent it on. That was this kind of folklore about the cat, that they were paid to go out at night and keep an eye on things for the devil. So they were very, very associated with him. It was very typical in reports of witches' sabbats to say that, you know, the devil would appear either in the guise of a goat or the guise of a cat. And, or, you know, of course, witches were also thought to keep black cats as familiars. It was very, very common to associate the black cat with witchcraft. And it really is a kind of nasty syncretism between Christianity and paganism, which had turned magic into something evil, and cats, which were emblematic of magic in many cultures, into something evil as well.
So I wanted to ask you about familiars. What was a familiar then? Was this just a witch's companion or more than that?
Yeah. A familiar was a companion, and you might have a kind of a clairvoyant or clairaudient relationship with it, but it wasn't necessarily a demon. A familiar was a companion that you had this special connection to. A demon or a demonically possessed entity or a demonically possessed cat, that was something else entirely. And it could do things that a familiar couldn't do. There's a very famous case in England, in Chelmsford, which is, I guess, it's a bit east of London. In Chelmsford, there was a very famous case of this woman named Agnes who had what was absolutely believed to be a demonically possessed cat by the name of Satan, by the way, which is a very telling name if you're a witch hunter. And she was a witch, and this cat, apparently she could speak to the cat. This cat did all kinds of things for her. This cat had killed a couple of people for her. It had actually committed infanticide because she decided she didn't want her cat. And so both she and the cat were put under arrest because this cat was absolutely believed to be not a familiar, but an actual demonically possessed animal.
Why cats specifically, do you think? And were there cases in your research where you saw other animals being possessed, or was it?
Yeah, of course. Other animals and other things. It's just cats were something that I kind of focused on because I'm very interested in cat lore and cat mythology personally. I happen to like cats a lot. And so it was just something I became interested in general, but other animals also, but cats in particular, there was this connection. Cats were thought to be a little bit closer to the devil. So cats were kind of the gateway animal. It was easier maybe for a demon to start with a cat and then, who knows, move on to a dog and then a person or something. Another thing about the cat that really irked Christian theologians was that a cat, if you own cats, you'll know that a cat is so independent that it really doesn't acknowledge your place as master of the home the way a dog might. And it was thought that cats were kind of contrary to providence, that cats didn't accept man's role as master, that cats were kind of, in that way, cats were a kind of natural affront to God because they didn't really accept man's dominance the way other animals did, the way dogs did. So cats also, for that reason, were thought to be a little bit infernal because they didn't seem to accept the natural order of things the way a dog would. You know, it's like if you live in a house with a cat, it's your house and the cat's house. If you live in the house with a dog, it's your house.
You're describing my cat very well.
That is the personality of the cat, and that was thought to be kind of antithetical to the divine order.
I think, you know, as I'm a cat owner, but at this point in my life, I've come to this cat relationship with a different approach than I had when I was younger. And when I was younger, I thought my cats loved me. And now that I'm older, I know my cats are not that into me.
Well, it might be, you know, they just don't show emotion in the same way. But, you know, you asked about the possession, and to make a point, as I said, it wasn't just people, it wasn't just camps, it was even objects could be thought to be possessed. There was one of the weirdest things I ever got involved in was going down to Chile, to this tiny little village called Parinacota that's right near the Bolivian border, to try to study some table that was believed to be possessed by something they didn't know what, either a demon or a ghost or something. And this table had been accused of murder and arrested, and they had it locked up in a room in the church because they said this table would come out at night and it would dance around in the street and it would stop on the front of someone's house, and this candelabra would light up, and then someone in the house would die. And so they had arrested the table and locked it up in a room in the church to prevent it from getting out and dancing around, because even the table was thought to be possessed. And there are stories. There is in the Kentucky Historical Museum, there's this thing that called the wedding chest or the marriage chest. That was a chest that was also thought to be possessed, and it was intimated that several people had died because of the mechanisms of this chest. So even objects could be thought to be possessed.
That's the worst table dance story I've ever heard. What?
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Yeah, it was one of the, as I said, it was pretty much the weirdest thing I've ever gotten involved in was that table.
All this talk of cat behavior is just making me think of Jackson Galaxy. Have you heard of him, Paul, at all? The Cat Whisperer?
No, I don't know him.
Oh, he's got a TV show. It's kind of like a Caesar Milan with dogs. He's a cat behaviorist. It's a very interesting show with people who have something akin to a demon cat, I think.
Is it like the Dog Whisperer, except every week he fails?
Every week he gets ignored, probably.
Right?
I don't have a TV, so I don't watch television. So I don't know. I'm putting together a kind of weird occult cat show here in Los Angeles where I live in November. And we do have a local psychic who has offered to do a cat seance for us. So I think that'll be very interesting.
Cool.
I believe people can contact cats in the real world.
That'd be something.
Right. It's hard enough to get through to them here. I don't know if she's going to get through to them there, but she's offered to do this cat seance for us. So I obviously said yes to that.
Good luck. That should be good TV. You're right. So from a spiritual perspective, I'm not sure if this is a religious question or just a conceptual question, but how do you deal with a cat that's been possessed by the devil? Do you exorcise it? Or is there a special way to get rid of it? Or what do you do?
Well, sadly, back in the day, the way they would typically deal with it is just kill the thing, unfortunately. And so a lot of probably innocent cats were killed in that way. That would be what you would do. You would try to dispel the demon the way you would try to dispel a demon from a person. Yeah, this still happens. By the way, there was not in the USA, not in Europe, but there was a famous case in Africa a couple of years ago of a cat that was crucified, actually, in a horrible cruelty. But the cat was crucified because they absolutely believed that the cat was possessed by a demon. And that was their way of getting rid of the demon, was to crucify the cat. There's even a horror movie that was made in Ghana about demonically possessed cats. It's called Demonic Cat. I've never seen the film. I have talked to horror film historians. No one's ever seen it, but the poster is absolutely fantastic, that I can tell you.
Yeah, you'd mentioned that a little earlier about cats and goats being tried for possession in Africa. So that is it a common thing, or is it something that we just occasionally hear a story of?
I don't know, because I've never studied that in Africa. I don't think it's that common. I think it's just something that is periodic. I don't know that.
In your research, what's been the most interesting demon cat case, in your opinion, that you've run into?
Well, I think just as an American, I kind of have a thing for the demonic cat in Washington, D.C. That's our national pride, right? That's our demon cat. So I kind of think he's fascinating, and he's been around. Reports of him have been around for about 150 years. No one knows exactly where he came from. He came along around the time of the U.S. Civil War. The first time he was ever seen was to Abraham Lincoln. The first time he ever grew to enormous size and became menacing was right before Lincoln had died. And there, so of course, there's a kind of conspiracy theory that maybe this demonic cat was planted in the U.S. Capitol building by Confederates or some kind of Confederate witch in order to undermine the Union. And he's still been around. He was supposedly appeared right before Kennedy was assassinated. I actually made a list that I have somewhere in my home of different times that cats supposedly had appeared in all the national tragedies or disasters that had happened soon afterward. And the last one, not surprisingly, was he was not seen, but supposedly Capitol workers, maintenance workers, heard this weird kind of meowing, growling sound from that basement where the cat's about to emanate from right before the September 11th attacks.
Is he considered to be a Republican or a demo cat?
Yeah, I think you got it there. I think he's a demo cat. He's a conservative demo cat.
So there are still a lot of superstitions that exist today about cats. Things like black cats crossing our paths being bad luck, or cats stealing the breath from babies. Would you say that these existing cat superstitions are related to these demonic legends, or that they're something different?
Cats were thought to be able to steal souls. And I think that might have something to do with this idea that maybe a cat can kill your infant, you know, because it has happened that maybe a cat lies on the baby's face and the baby suffocates. And I've been told there are reasons for that, you know, that the cat might do that. And of course, it's not because it's evil. Maybe it likes the warmth of the baby's breath or something. I know I'd heard something about that. But I think that might be one of the reasons that cats were thought to be able to steal people's souls. You know, it's not that cats could steal a soul and take it down to hell, and you had to protect a dead body from cats specifically until it was interred properly. And especially in Scotland, this was extremely popular, and there was a ritual, I believe it was called the Seal Fadlock, and it was performed to keep what they called the cat's sea away from dead bodies in the Scottish Highlands. And these were supposed to be these large black cats that could emanate sparks. And if they got near a dead body, they would steal the soul by jumping over it and take it all the way down to hell.
What about protecting yourself from a demon cat? Were there any specially prescribed steps that people needed to do in order to save themselves from such things?
Yeah, and it was a really nasty one. This is Scottish English also. It's UK. It's Britannia. And what you would have to do, this is an almost unspeakable animal brutality, but you had to stay awake for 3 days. And for 3 days, you had to keep roasting cats over an open fire. So you had to gather together a bunch of cats. And if you would roast them over, you would just keep roasting them until each one expired. And if you did this for 3 days straight without sleeping, then the devil supposedly would appear to you in the guise of a cat and ask you to stop incinerating his servants and protect you from cat magic and also give you second sight.
Wow.
A nice bonus? What?
Yeah, you'd get the bonus out of it. But yeah, unspeakable act of animal cruelty. You had to continue to roast.
No, it's horrible. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, my mom always told me, if you put salt on a bird's tail, you can catch it. Which, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I would try this. And of course, if you could get close enough to the bird to catch it, you would,
you know what I mean? With the salt on the tail, you can
right.
Catch
so
it,
I, when your story starts out with the devil will give you superpowers if you can herd some cats, I mean, maybe it wasn't as common as it was disturbing. So.
Yeah, that was that, but that was a famous way of protecting yourself, was this burning of the cats for 3 days straight.
That's messed up.
Kind of extreme.
You couldn't sleep during that time. You had to stay away for 3 days and do this constantly.
I wonder if anyone actually did.
I don't know, but this was the method.
Do you remember where you read that?
Don't off the top of my head, but it is definitely something that I found in a book.
Yeah,
definitely something I found in an old book of cat lore or demonic lore. I don't remember exactly where I got that, but I found it in a couple different books. It definitely existed, or at least it was thought to exist.
It's just strange. Something you said earlier reminded me of the witch's hammer.
Yeah, the Malus Maleficarum.
Yeah, so when you were talking about the idea that Satan had no power himself, you know,
that was a theological point, and they make that in that book, you know, because anything that the devil does is a glimmer; it's not real. You know, there were these stories, I believe it was from the Malleus Maleficarum, of witches who would steal men's penises, but they wouldn't really be gone. And they would hide them in these, even though they weren't there, they were these phantasms of penises, and they would hide them in nests or something and treat them like birds. It's a very, very strange thing. But the devil had no actual power, and it's a theological point that was of importance, because only God can create. The devil cannot create. Only the creator can create. So anything that comes from an infernal power is a faux miracle. It's a glimmer, or it's a phantasm, and everyone believes that it happens, but it can't actually happen, because only God can actually create or change substance. Only God can transubstantiate.
It's a horrible book full of terrible tortures, but it's also a really, I don't know how else to describe it, it's a biblical nerddom. I mean, it's a really, there's like this really nerdy conversation that starts out the whole thing about this minutia of what's possible and what's not. It's a very interesting read.
It is. I actually did my master's thesis on depictions of witchcraft in Northern Renaissance art. I'm quite familiar with all that stuff. And that book was the most famous, and it was the first, but it was only one of many.
I'm just amazed that there's so much cat lore out there as well. It's such a specific topic.
Well, cats have been around for a long time. You know, one of the theories is, had we not been such bastards to cats at one time, and we really were, you know, they would burn them for fun or burn them at rituals, and it was thought to be a good thing. When Queen Elizabeth was crowned, there were a certain number of cats that were actually burned in effigy, and I forget how many that were. It was just a portent of good things. You know, there's this theory that maybe if we hadn't been such bastards to the cats, we might have saved ourselves from the bubonic plague.
So Elizabeth the First, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got a question, kind of a sideline thing. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but were strays more likely to be demon cats than house cats, or did it not make any difference?
Yeah, you know, that's a more complex question than you realize, because they didn't really have house cats the way we do. Pet keeping, as we know it, it's really an invention of the 19th century. You know, people have always had animals around, but pets, as we know them, you know, these kind of special companions, this is something that was not all that common before the 19th century. You know, that the relationship that we have with them now, that almost spiritual familial relationship, is something that's really kind of new. People would have cats. One of the things that was suspicious about witches is they had such a close relationship with the cat. Sometimes if you read the literature, kind of like our relationships with cats now, you know, this intimate familial relationship. And that in itself was suspect, because someone would have that close relationship with an animal, because it wasn't normal at the time to treat an animal as if it were actually a member of the family. There's an interesting papal bull that was issued in, I believe it was 1484, and it said that regarding, you know, this closeness with cats, it said in this bull that all cat worshippers should be pursued as witches or arrested and treated as witches, not witchcraft first, but cats before witches. You know, just that closeness to a cat indicated that you must be involved in witchcraft because it was so suspect.
Mm-hmm. A really interesting
an
insult.
Evil.
Yeah, but there's a lot of really horrible stuff in the kitty literature.
Right.
But this is so fascinating. So
it is. Yeah.
So you're giving lectures this time of the year, or is that what's going on with that? As far as
I've done a couple. Okay. I have the more mundane book lectures that my publisher, frankly, would prefer that I stick with. And I'm doing one in Newcastle, but at the same time, I'm going to be passing through London, and so I arranged through a friend of mine to do a cat lecture there about the demonically possessed cats on October 18th at St. Pancras Old Church. I love talking about this stuff, and I love doing this lecture because it's a lot of fun, and the audience always really enjoys it. And I'm doing, as I said, I'm putting on this kind of occult cat show in Los Angeles on November 5th at the Steve Allen Theater. You know, I don't know to what extent I believe any of it. I mean, I'm the guy who went all the way to Chile to look at a demonically possessed table. I don't know how much I believe any of this stuff, but I'm absolutely fascinated by it. I do know that other people believe or have believed in it, and I think it's an interesting field to study.
Skeptics, but yeah, we're interested in it too.
Have you had any interesting claims from people who attend your lectures that they have a demon cat or that they've seen a demon cat before?
Well, I had a lady who lives in San Leandro, California, up by Berkeley, contact me when I was in, I had gone up to San Francisco and I had done a lecture about the demonically possessed cats and I had wound up getting in the newspaper and there was this kind of picture of me and said, you know, it's like expert on demonic cats, which I'm really not. I probably know more than anybody else about it, just studied it, but I'm no expert. I can't fix it, you know, if it's gone wrong in that way. But because of that, you know, and because it's San Francisco, I got an awful lot of emails from people about their cats. And there was this one strange email, a very compelling email I got from a woman in San Leandro who believed that her cat had died recently. And she believed that her cat's ghost was living in her frying pan. And that somehow the frying pan had been malfunctioning. The handle kept falling off. And she blamed it on the fact that there had been this, that the cat's ghost had taken up residence in the frying pan. She said when she cooked with the frying pan, she would hear this strange hissing sound. So I talked to her for a while and I met with her for a while. In the end, I don't know that I really believe, I don't even know if I believe in ghosts, but you know, and if I do, I don't know if I believe this cat's ghost was living in the frying pan. But in the end, I kind of got drawn into her drama because the cookware store where she bought the frying pan, they offered her an exchange because she didn't want a broken frying pan. She said the handle, there was something wrong with the handle and it would come off. And they offered to exchange it if she would return the old frying pan, but she insisted on keeping the old frying pan because she was afraid that her cat was living in it. So as far as the cookware store is concerned, she just wanted another free frying pan and they refused to give it to her. So I got involved in this strange and negotiation with customer service to try to get this woman a free frying pan. And in the end, I wrote this actually really magnificent letter in which I kind of made her case about the cat. And I got into the right guy's hands who claimed that, well, you know, I do remember when my dog died. I did feel a presence in the house. So she actually got another frying pan for her trouble, which I thought was nice, you know, in corporate America, that there is some chance that they'll acknowledge that just maybe the ghost of your cat is in their product and give you a new one.
Yeah, that's a good story too.
Yeah.
But although it makes me wonder of how to get rid of something like that. I mean, would you even bother calling a priest if you've already failed with the friar?
Right. Yeah. Well done.
I should have warned you about his puns before we started.
I don't, I really don't know what a priest would even say, by the way, if you called them and told them that you had a possessed frying pan. I just don't know. Catholic Church doesn't like the idea of possession very much anymore, so if you're claiming it for an inanimate object, they might just hang up on you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's pretty rare.
Yeah, well, yeah,
medium rare, yeah. Oh, you're a bad influence.
I'm terrible. I'm sorry. I'm incorrigible.
That is a fascinating story, though.
It really
I wonder
is.
I wonder how she's doing now and with this new pan.
She mailed me a picture of the cat while it was alive with a kind of – she had put in a little cartoon balloon. The cat's name was Angus, and it said, you know, Angus thanks you, and she had – kind of written a little note thanking me because I guess, you know, the new frying pan is working. She has the old one that the cat lives in and it's all good.
Wow.
Well, that's good for her.
Poor dear. Sounds like there are some issues there.
Well, it's...
Well, her husband didn't. Her husband was really skeptical about this. That, I must say, her husband didn't like the idea.
Yeah.
Of his wife going to the cookingware store telling them that there was a ghost living in the pan.
Yeah.
But you're married and, you know, you make allowance.
Well, you love them in spite of it, you know.
Right. But you know, we see a lot of this, you know, in our skeptical investigations of the paranormal. And it seems like a lot of it's misascribed agency. Like they see agency in things that aren't there or maybe nobody else sees.
Yeah. You know, people have this tendency. They want to jump from point A all the way to point Z without going through all the points in between. It's not that I don't believe in any of this stuff. I'm willing to accept it, but you need to get there through. You need to get there through an acceptable channel, you know. And I think that's what you mean. They like to ascribe agency. I remember because I'm interested in some of this stuff, and I talk about it in my research. And I get calls from friends, and I remember I was talking to this girl once, who was telling me, you know, I think there's a ghost in my house, and I was over at her house. And I was like, well, why do you think there's a ghost here? She's like, well, all this stuff was knocked over last night, and I don't know what could have happened. And I was like, well, you know, there's these bottles of vodka and these empty beer bottles everywhere. Are you sure you just didn't get drunk and knock things down? She's like, well, yeah, I was drunk, but I think there's a ghost, you know. And if you're jumping from point A to point Z, let's look at it rationally. Let's work through the possible. Let's look through all the possibilities. And then if you really can't answer, then let's accept the paranormal at that time. But I think you have to work through a series of channels first to get there.
Yeah, that's definitely something we try to teach as well.
Yeah, there's that whole thing they call the argument from ignorance. And if we could probably just cancel this show and just say argument from ignorance, and that's 90% of it, maybe more. But it's fun to talk about and fun to hear the lore and fun to hear the way people have constructed explanations over the years. So, or maybe there's demon cats, but, you know, I too would need to see some more proof. And I say demon, I mean demon possessed.
Exactly.
Paul, we always like to ask our guests one particular question. We like to end with this question. What's your favorite monster?
Oh, okay. You know what? I'll take the Blemmy. Are you familiar with the Blemmy?
Now, that sounds extremely familiar. I think I actually know what that is.
I don't.
The Blemmy is that thing that has no – it's a person that has no head but a face in the middle
of
its chest.
Yes,
I love the Blemmy. And, you know, the guy who wrote about that was Walter Raleigh, because Walter Raleigh, in his travel book from Guyana, Walter Raleigh insisted that he had actually seen the Blemmy in Guyana, and the original editions of his book all include an engraving of the Blemmy kind of running through the field. If you've seen an old image, an old engraving of the Blemmy, these guys with no heads and the faces in the center of the chest running through a field, that's actually from Walter Raleigh, and that's what he claimed that he had seen in Guyana.
That's the English traveler, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's him. It's Walter Raleigh, very important guy. It's, you know, Walter Raleigh, I don't think Walter Raleigh believed that he had seen the Blemmy. I think Walter Raleigh believed that his audience would only accept his story if he had claimed he had seen monsters, because at that point in time it was part of the rhetoric of traveler. But the Blemmy has been around since Roman times. The Blemmy has been around since a really long time, because they kind of had this, the Romans and the Greeks both had this theory that, you know, the further away you got from civilization, which was defined as being Roman or Greek, the more barbaric people came, the more the more subhuman they became. So it was absolutely believed if you got all the way to someplace like Sumatra, you would actually see things like the Blemmy, because they were subhuman, because they weren't Roman. And so that had kind of stayed around even in Christian times. And so a lot of explorers would talk about them. And Walter Raleigh, as I said, even included the Blemmy. But I just love those guys. They're such a good image. You know, those guys standing there with no heads and the faces in the center of their chest. So,
yeah.
Favorite monster, I'll take the Blemmy, I think.
I think it's good. We actually covered the Blemmy. We did a couple of episodes of Monster Talk on map monsters. One with Chet Van Duzer, who studies antiquary maps, and one with Asa Mittman from California State University. He's an art historian as well. And you may, I don't know if you know his work or whatever, but he.
I don't.
Yeah, he's also done map monsters. So maps and monsters in medieval England. And so, yeah, you might want to check those out.
The Blemmy were often pictured in the marginalia of maps.
Exactly.
You know, to kind of represent things you would find in the exotic part of the world.
Yeah.
That and potatoes.
and tobacco. Tobacco, Blemmies, corn, all these evil things, you know, you'd find them if you went to America.
That's so funny.
Well, that's a great answer. That's the first time we've heard that one for the favorite monster
question. That's true. It's excellent. So, well, thank you very much. What I'll do is I'll put the links and information for your upcoming talks in London and in Los Angeles. We have a lot of listeners in California and a lot of listeners in England. So hopefully that'll get you some additional butts and seats.
Great. Thank you very much, guys.
Well, thanks for being on Monster Talk. We appreciate it.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and you just heard Dr. Karen Stolznow and me interview Dr. Paul Kutinaris about demonic cat possession. On October 16th and October 18th, Dr. Kutinaris will be giving lectures in London on his research. On the 16th, he'll be covering art and death, and on the 18th, he'll be discussing demonically possessed cats. If you're able to attend, he is an art historian, and many of his stories have images that will add to the presentation. He also has an upcoming presentation in November in Los Angeles. Check our show notes at monstertalk.org for more information. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed in this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If all goes well, we'll have a fascinating interview next episode that combines vampires and poltergeists. Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to help this show, please share it with a friend who likes monsters. Monster Talk exists because I believe you can love monsters and folklore, but not have to treat the topics uncritically. I'm recording this on October 13th, my birthday. Want to give me a birthday present? Just give our show a review on iTunes. It's free, and it really helps new people find the show. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
To stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
Forceps. Cut some bomb scissors. Ten blade scalpel.
Ten blade.
Sponge stick. Give me a little sweat on my upper lip. Okay, remove sweat.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.